the Garden Nerd Tip of the Week podcast. I'm Christy Wilhelmi. Thanks for joining us, and welcome to our new format where we spend time chatting with expert gardening guests to ask for their favorite tip. My guest today is Jessica Aldridge, Sustainability and Zero Waste Programs Manager in the waste industry. She is a true advisor, Executive Director of Adventures in Waste, and winner of Waste 360's inaugural 40 Under 40 Award in 2016 for her work in resource management, environmental protection, and community partnerships. Jessica's passion is environmental education, and she has created zero waste and recycling programs for organizations and cities throughout Southern California. Jessica, I have been dying to have you on the Garden Nerd podcast for so long. I mean, it's really been years. Welcome to the Tip of the Week podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited about it, too.
Yay! Because we've been on a panel together, and I have to apologize again for usurping most of the time on the panel, because that wasn't intended. I thought we were going to be trading off, and then suddenly it was like 40 minutes in, and I'm the only one talking. So I get to make it up today by having you do most of the talking. All right, so let's start at the beginning. How did you come to environmental education, and what is a true advisor?
Yeah, my story is, I call myself a mountain girl. So I grew up in the mountains of Utah for 10 years, from the time I was like 10 years old to the time I was graduated college and left and came here to California. So environment and environmental protection has always been something that has been part of my heart. And looking back at my yearbook, I realized, I was like, oh yeah, I started the recycling cup at
your high school. That is so forward thinking.
I'd totally forgotten that I had done that.
That's awesome.
But I moved here in California with my ex, who is a scientist, and moved here and was in the entertainment industry for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And my degree is in business and the entertainment industry.
Oh.
And I was working for a hospital, Providence St. Joseph Medical Center, and they said, we want to start a green team, and we don't know what we're going to do, and does anyone have any ideas? And I wrote back this like 3-page dissertation about what I thought they should be doing.
So you have some passion around this.
Just a little passion. Like, do you want to be the chair of the environmental committee?
Okay, that's so great.
And because of that, you know, helping them, the first thing we tackled was their recycling program and the lack thereof, or thinking that they had one, but they really didn't.
Yeah,
and
hospitals have a lot of waste.
They have a lot of waste. And this hospital had a lot of recycling containers and no actual recycling dumpster.
Wow.
And they weren't even doing what's called mixed waste processing. It was just all going into the landfill. And so we had to set, that was the first goal, was to set this up for them. And when I did that, I started doing more research and realizing that, and this was 15 years ago, so I'm realizing that this concept, this industrial term of zero waste existed, and that there were consultants that were working under this concept that was developed by the UN National Accords to have a zero waste plan in all these different cities. And they had the leaders in Burbank, from the Burbank Recycle Center and others, had decided we're going to have a zero waste goal in the city of Burbank. And that's where the hospital was. So okay. I met with the Recycle Center. I met with who became my mentor, Craig Hample, who's also a big permacultural kind of guy.
Got it.
And I said, what is this zero waste thing? And how do I get involved here? And how do I become a consultant? How do I leave the hospital and come and do this? And an opportunity came up where they had a stint where they were creating a zero waste program and an event, and said we need a zero waste event coordinator for 3 months. So I got hired to do that. Mm-hmm. At the city, and it was a crash course. It was a crash course for like 2 years of just learning the industry from the top people in the industry, the people who started the Zero Waste International Alliance and started the actual that formed the definition, the international definition of zero waste. Rick Anthony and Gary Liss, and then coming in Stephanie Barger, who is now leading into the True Advisor, who with them, they originally started what was called the Zero Waste business certification. Uh-huh. And there's different certifications out there in regards to green businesses, right? And there's a few different waste ones out there. And they started what was the first zero waste certification. Eventually, the Green Business Certification Incorporated, which also has LEED certification, WELL building, all of those, decided that they would like to have that part of their portfolio. Uh-huh. And so they took that zero waste business certification and they bought that up. They, you know, put a part as their portfolio, and then it turned into what is now called TRUE.
So you're a TRUE advisor, and what do you do with that? What's your thing?
Well, I actually, for the TRUE advisor, there are different levels of how you can utilize that information. But they teach people how to go into businesses and help those businesses get up to the point. It's like a lead advisor.
Right.
You know the system, you know what they need to have in place in order to that for that business to get their zero waste certification. So the TRUE advisor is either a consultant or maybe they work for that business. So a lot of what I had previously learned from the people who created the mm-hmm. TRUE advisor and what, you know, I have learned from that, I can take into the businesses that I work with the company that I work for and also with my nonprofit, and put the resources and the information out there so that these businesses can, you know, take on the industrial term of zero waste and start implementing aspects into their daily activities.
Cool. And what is your nonprofit?
My nonprofit is Adventures in Waste.
Adventures in Waste.
Yes.
Okay. What does Adventures in Waste do?
Yes. Well, Adventures in Waste started as Burbank Green Alliance.
Okay.
So when I was with the city and the city wanted to start a business group around sustainability, not just waste, but around sustainability, we started as the Green Business Information Exchange.
Oh, catchy.
Very sexy. And yeah, that changed real quick. So when I was working for the city, we started that. And then when when my job at the city ended, I decided not to move forward with city, but to try to do consulting. And we took that and turned it into under a nonprofit under a fiscal sponsor, which is C, Social Environmental Entrepreneurs. And we were doing massive amounts of outreach and resource development and coalition building and workshops and film screenings, tons every single year. But then as I got more and more work and got my full-time job in the waste industry, that kept going less and less and less.
Right.
From there, we helped to found what is the local chapter of 350.org, so SoCal 350.
Oh, you're part of that. Excellent.
Yes.
I'm signed up. I get the newsletters, and I have the T-shirt, the Do the Math T-shirt and all of that stuff from Bill McKibben's when he came out here.
Hey.
So that SoCal 350, by the way, everyone who's listening, it's really important to understand that we are past peak oil and we need to stop pumping oil out of the ground and find ways to sequester carbon back in the soil. And if you want to learn all the things you need to know about how to do that, go to 350. It's SoCal350.org.
Yeah, SoCal. Yeah, SoCal350.org.
Awesome.
So we were one of the major founders of that.
Awesome.
The first meeting being in our house because we wanted to do this coalition building largest environmental march in California, which was, I think, 5 years ago, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I realized that through that, I really wanted to, when I got my feet back underneath me, just working in the waste industry and so much work that had to be done, City of Los Angeles is going through the largest waste transition in the nation's history right now, and I'm part of that.
Oh, great.
And so once that started to settle down, I wanted to take Burbank Green Alliance and turn it into a waste-oriented nonprofit, but not just your everyday blog, but to pull all the resources that I have and the resources that those people in the industry have mm-hmm. and create a bridge between the industry and the everyday person that really wants this information, that wants to know where to go to get more information and to be a sort of resource hub, but also give an opportunity for those people in the industry to write, mm-hmm. to blog, to share their pictures, to get information out there. So website's not completely done yet, and
okay.
it probably won't be. It will never be 100% done because it's a resource site.
Right.
But
it's never done.
It hopefully will have its major legs come this fall.
Okay.
And yeah, so there's people working on it at the moment.
Excellent. So. Well, we'll share that information with the audience. Okay, so I saw you do a presentation at an Earth Day event, and I think that was my first encounter of you. And it was about what you can and can't recycle, and it was both really informative and incredibly sobering because there was so much that I thought you could recycle that you really can't recycle. And I was thinking, I just need this woman in my brain at all times to tell me what I'm supposed to do. Can you share some of the basic information about what's recyclable and what isn't? I know it's a huge subject, but let's talk about the stuff that people toss in the recycling bin. Let's start maybe there with what people toss in the recycling bin that they probably shouldn't.
Well, I first want to say, I think a lot of people think recycling is free.
Yeah.
And we've created a model in our cities where we make it look like it's free. Or when you go out and people are like, well, you're taking my recyclables. You should be making a lot of money off of this stuff. Where's my payback for it?
Oh, boy.
And recycling is very expensive. It's cheap, and it's really cheap in the state of California to landfill or trash. Our tipping fee with tip means to tip the stuff onto the floor.
Yep.
Right? And how much are you going to get paid to tip that? Or how much do you have to pay to tip that container? Right? And so it's really cheap. Our tipping fee in California for trash is really cheap in comparison to recycling. And then it's really expensive to pick up and process organics. And that's a whole nother conversation.
So how does that compare just really quickly to the rest of the country? Because there are people who listen to this all over the world. But is it relatively the same in terms of which is it more expensive throughout the country?
No. So in essence, conceptually, it would be, landfill will always be cheaper, but cities like New York and them have really high tipping fees on the landfill in order to even out the cost of what the recycling would be and what the organics would be. So it's like, yeah, your organics might cost you $150 a ton to collect and process and go through that whole entire thing. But if your landfill rate is $30 a ton, how about we make your landfill rate $100 a ton in order to bring down the cost of the organics?
Okay.
So it's not like that across the country, but there are certain states and certain cities that do recognize that as an opportunity to fund better participation from the consumer to the processor in that model.
Sorry, real quick, just for the audience. And by organics, you mean kitchen waste and yard waste that goes into the green bin.
Yeah, it starts to get more and more expensive the more stuff that you put in there. Because the heavier something is, the more expensive it is to ship it.
Got it.
Some cities are only able to do their organic. Some cities don't even have organics collection.
Yeah.
Some do, and we call it curbside, your curb of your house, which you're able to put out there. And some are able to do just the plant matter from your garden. So you're talking about your tree matter and your grass and your clippings and yard trimmings and that sort of thing. Others, and not as much, but it's becoming more widespread, or, you know, looking at being able to take some of the food scrap. But you have to be cited as a compost facility of if it's out aerobic or in vessel. You have to be cited to be able to take food.
Yeah,
and
that can
expensive.
Be complicated. I've heard of people who are trying to do larger scale composting projects than just at their home, and they're having to go through permitting, and it's very complicated.
It's a complicated and it's expensive.
Yeah,
and there's state regs, and then there's federal regs, and there's all this.
So, in terms of what people can recycle, what does that look like?
Yeah, so we. And it's also based on what the market looks like. So if the market bears, if there's markets for it to purchase this stuff, that potentially means it's going potentially to get recycled.
Right.
Just because something's recyclable doesn't mean that there's a market for it. That doesn't mean that it's actually going to get recycled. And just because a manufacturer says, I can recycle this product, and they're the only person in the world that can recycle it, it doesn't mean that it's actually recyclable.
Okay.
The products that I would say on everyday people that put in their container, until your city tells you they can't take something, continue putting it in there. But be aware that there are certain products that here in the state of California, is going to be different than one is on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. I just saw a post the other day that promoted the recycling of number one plastic, and everyone thinks that number one plastic is the go-to. That's the good plastic. Mm-hmm. It's always recyclable. But the thing is, in the state of California, we want water bottles. There's a difference between recycling a molded water bottle and a thermoform number one plastic. Thermoform is a molded plastic. It's all everything else. It's your to-go containers. It's your little bowl. It's your pot for your plants. Mm-hmm. Those, that's a different type of number one plastic. And when they buy the bottles, they don't want that plastic. The markets don't want that. On the East Coast, there are some places that will take all the number one plastic. They separate out the bottles, they separate out the molded thermoform stuff. But here in California, and usually west of the Mississippi, number one plastic, molded plastic, doesn't really have as high of a value. And even when they were, right now we're not, but when they were doing what's called mixed plastic, mm-hmm. where they would mix a variant between 3 through 7 number plastics, they didn't even want the ones in there.
Wow.
And so a lot of people think that's the go-to plastic.
Right. And we looked outside at several different garden-related products, like 4-inch pots and 6-packs. And each of them, it seemed, had a different number on the bottom. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that was funny. Like flipping over, like, well, that's okay. That's that one.
Right. There were 5s, there were 2s, there were 1s. And
there
ones...
was a repeat, which is a recycled PET, recycled water bottle. So they're closing the loop one time around, right?
But that you said that it doesn't necessarily mean that that can be recycled.
Yeah, because it's the falls under that one molded uh-huh. plastic again. So the and then the other thing, we have to look at color.
Right.
So when we want, if they're going to take PET, they usually want clear and white. They don't want all the other colors that come with it because it makes it harder. It's just a harder process, or the, you know, the feedstock when they chop it up and they sell it, it's not as high valued. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those little containers are black plastic. Mm-hmm. Black plastic is very, it's doesn't have as much value, and when it goes through the system, it's going to be thrown into the mixed 3 through 7 plastic, which is not valuable at the moment. It's not, doesn't really have a value on the open market. And when it did, it seriously was usually the recycling facilities would pay for a recycling company to take it, because at least paying for a manufacturer to take it mm-hmm. was actually cheaper than the tip fee for the landfill.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, but the black, stepping back a second, we need, in order to recycle more, we need better infrastructure. And California really needs better recycling infrastructure. We can collect this stuff, we can sort this stuff, but then when it's being sorted, it needs to be sorted properly. So we need recycling facilities that can even step it up. We need to slow down the lines. If they don't have what's called optical sorters, which is a machine that looks, uses technology to read the resin code of, or the chemical signature, I guess, of the product. And then a burst of air shoots up, and then it's like, yeah, that's a number one bottle. I want that product. It shoots up and hits that bottle, and it jumps over into another section.
That's high tech.
Yeah, very high tech. It came from the agricultural industry when they were looking for fruits and vegetables that didn't fit what they thought the mold was, if
right.
it was bruised or if it looked a little funky.
Yeah. And food waste is a whole other conversation. We're not going to get there right now, but food waste is huge.
Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah.
So with the black plastic, well, with the optical sorters, you're able to identify plastic that you may want. The reason why those 3 through 7 bells were popular to the manufacturers or to the buyers mm-hmm. was because they were getting at the polypropylene, which is the number 5. And the number 5 plastic has really high market value. Mm-hmm. But if you're a recycling facility that's able to identify the number 5, then your 3 through 7 might not sell as much, but now you have this really high commodity, this polypropylene number 5, which is like your yogurt cups and pots for your plants. But the black the optical sorter can't read through the to the chemical signature of the plaque, so the plaque ends up being waste.
Okay.
So you have those, and then also the thinner your plastic, the more lightweight your plastic, the more you could just rip that plastic apart. Again, it has very little to no value. And so a lot of these containers, the best option is to just continue to reuse them, give them back to people who can use them, especially the pots, because they're a little bit strong. You'll find that the number 5 pots are stronger than the number 6s, which is polystyrene, which is foam.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. And so, right, so the 6-packs are often very flimsy, and they come apart. They will be, you can cut them into segments and whatnot, and they collapse very easily. So for those, I know the 6-packs, our Master Gardener program wants those because they grow seedlings for people at the farmers markets and whatnot. And so they redistribute those 6-packs. And I know, I think you had mentioned on the phone when we were talking that you can take the 4-inch pots. Usually nurseries will take them back. Do you know of any other ways to repurpose them?
Just people who want them. I mean, you can work with the farmers markets where people are actually giving pots away and be like, hey, I have a bunch of pots. Would you like to take this? So anywhere that someone is growing plants, mm-hmm. they may want your pots because that makes it so that they don't have to buy anymore.
And that works for seed flats and the trays that you bring them home in too, I assume. I know that around here, so we have a group on Facebook called Buy Nothing Mar Vista, and it's part of the Zero Waste Buy Nothing thing, whatever that is. And there's one for Culver City, and there's one for Venice, and one for Santa Monica. So we have one Buy Nothing Mar Vista. And so I put up, I had probably 150 4-inch pots out there after a very busy spring season planting for people. And I just put it out there and said, hey, does anybody want some? And a bunch of school teachers who have student gardens or kid garden, you know, kid school gardens, they wanted them, so they all came and took them away. So I guess the recycling through humans rather than the distribution or the, you know, maintenance.
Yeah, the reuse through humans, I try to say, because recycling is taking a product, breaking it down, and turning it into another product of greater or lesser value. And the reuse is sustaining its value and getting, you know, continuously using that product until you can no longer use it.
Yeah.
And, we can't recycle our way out of our problem and of the issues that are happening. We have to look upstream. We have to push on corporations to be doing the right thing. And us as humans, we can't say, well, why I only create this much waste and in this little container, or you could do as well as I could. But that's not the reality for everyone. And we all live different lives and we all have access in different ways. And you're going to plant plants and you're going to need the containers for them. And so if we can just circulate that in our community as long as we can, that's great. And eventually when it needs to go into the trash can, we recognize that that is where it's going. And accept, you know, recognize and then accept like, okay, but I'm doing my best in order to minimize the use of these containers. And not buying new every single time if possible.
Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about other plastics that we use in gardening, like watering cans and old garden hoses and, you know, garden gloves and that kind of thing. I assume that that stuff all pretty much has to go in the landfill. Have you run across a use for any of those, or are they recyclable?
Well, your gardening can, if it's metal, that definitely will take any metal in the recycling. And also if the metal... Well, the market's a little funky right now.
Right, because China's not accepting our recyclables anymore. So what is that? How does that shift from your perspective what we can recycle, what we should and shouldn't be putting in the blue bin?
Mm-hmm. Again, I just want to point out that you have to follow what your city is telling you. Mm-hmm. They may be behind the buck. They may have not decided what they want to do. They may want to continue doing it the old way because they feel that it will even itself out in a year or so, and to go back and educate and then re-educate and re-educate again it starts to cause confusion. And once you tell someone that something can go into the container and then you tell them it can't, they, mm-hmm. you know, you're always going to get that product in the container. So first, yes, check with your recycling company, check with your city, see what they are doing. The issue with China is not China, it's us.
Of course it is.
And it's not China's fault that they don't want us to dump our waste on them 24/7.
Yeah.
They are recycling product. They are taking stuff, but they have a very low contamination threshold. And by 2020, they're really going to stop taking scrap metal and most other paper and other scrap product. They're willing to take that material once it's been processed and for plastic pelletized.
Mm-hmm.
They're willing to take the pelletized material and bring it back in. They definitely want paper. They just won't take contaminated paper. But the contamination rate is 0.5%. So it's very low and it's very hard to get to.
Hmm.
So they're taking a lot of pre-consumer material because that's a lot easier to control on the contamination side.
Right.
With China, the industry is looking at other markets. So they're looking at Vietnam and Thailand and other places that potentially will take this material. But those countries are getting smart too. And they're like, wait a minute, you know, I have abandoned, people are bringing over waste in these shipping containers and then there's no owner. They're being abandoned. I don't know where this is, you know, and so they've been starting, especially Vietnam, has been starting to put regulations in place now to say, we're going to have to start looking at contamination. The other issue is that the United States is putting tariffs on product that is coming over from China.
Mm-hmm.
And then so China's turning around and putting the same 25% tariff on product that's coming into China. So even if China wanted to take our stuff, there's a 25% tariff on that. So a lot of the companies in the United States, a lot of recycling companies in the United States don't want to send it to China because it's now starting to become too expensive to even be able to utilize this material. And when we recycle, if we really are supportive of recycling and we want recycling to work, we have to buy recycled content. We have to, as consumers, support the infrastructure as, and not just consumers like the individual person like you and me, but the businesses, the corporations. We have to have what's called extended producer responsibility, where they're taking responsibility for the product they're putting out so that it is recyclable, and that they're also putting recycled content in that product so that they're supporting the system and the infrastructure. The other issue, which is kind of good about the China situation, is that we as a country are having to take a major step back and say, oh, so we're not supposed to be exporting our responsibility and dumping our trash onto someone else's suffering.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not right. Oh, okay. We need to actually build infrastructure here.
Yes.
And we have the technology in order to build the infrastructure in a way that is not environmentally degrading and that, so you don't have to create a bunch of air and water pollution in order to be able to recycle paper at the mass amounts that we want. And we do recycle paper in this country, but we're maxed out because the infrastructure is not here to support it.
To process those materials into something new.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so we need the infrastructure here to have the recycling facilities that are upgraded, that have the optical sorting, that are able to get through more material. And then we need the infrastructure here that's going to take that material, buy it, pelletize it, or melt it down or whatever the process is for the product itself and get it into a form that it can then be turned into a new product. And then we need the manufacturers who are going to turn that into new product. Now, at that point, China would probably, if there was no tariff, would love to buy that from us.
Sure.
Because it's beautiful. But the other issue is we have too much stuff in the system in order to be able to process all of it. So if we're like, but it's recyclable, and we have what if we have the recycling facility infrastructure? What if we had the manufacturer being able to break this stuff down and turn it into new content that could be put into, you know, a table where the table is 100% recycled content or it's 50% recycled content, post-consumer content? That's great. But we don't have enough tables and chairs and carpets and all this other stuff in order to utilize the amount of material that we have coming into the stream. And that's where it comes to this conversation of consumption. And then also taking the shame and the judgment of consumption off of the actual downstream consumer and putting it back onto the corporation. And why do we are capitalism is pushed on us.
Yeah.
We don't buy into capitalism. We have to buy into capitalism.
Right. And I love what you're saying about putting it on the manufacturer to be responsible for their materials, because everything comes in a package, and it's if they made it something that, or reduced their packaging, or made the packaging reusable or reducible or whatever into something else, then and create the infrastructure around that to reuse it or recycle it into something else, that would be responsible. There's that book came out a long time ago called Cradle to Cradle, yeah, that is all about that exact thing. And the book itself that you're reading is sustainably produced all the way, you know, and can be recycled and all of those things. So that's thank you for saying that. It's really important. I want to talk a little bit about composting, because I know, when we were on that panel together, you were warning people against composting clothing and, you know, the takeout boxes that have the coating on the inside, the food takeout boxes. Can you talk a little bit about why that's, you know, why you were warning people against those items in the compost bin?
Yeah, we have to be cautious of our items and know what they are. Mm-hmm. So with clothing, 80% of the clothes that we have, I think that's the number, is made with fake fibers.
Synthetic materials.
Yeah. So it's not cotton. Cotton has its own issues. Mm-hmm. But it's not real. And so we don't want that material. When we're composting, you're going to end up with these synthetic materials, these plastics, in your compost. When you're using a compost facility that, a high-end compost facility that says, oh, I can take all this material, mm-hmm, they, in order to sell to their, in order to get the license from the state, mm-hmm, to be able to sell to organic farms, they can't have inorganic material in their compost. And those fibers are inorganic material. Okay. With the boats or the little to-go containers, you have to be careful there too, because unless it's 100% fiber-based material, there's going to be some sort of liner. And that liner is going to be plastic. It's going to be wax, which is usually now plastic, or it's going to be what's called a polylactic acid or another form of bioplastic. Mm-hmm. And those bioplastics in your backyard aren't really made to break down. Even the Federal Trade Commission has standards on how you can label something compostable and what you have to put on the language. And it says you have to take those to a high heat facility. So unless your municipality is partnering, has their own high heat facility, or is partnering with a waste provider, collector, or processor that has a high heat facility, that those fiber containers with those polylactic acid liners might not be able to be processed. Now, again, then your compost facility too may just not want polylactic acid to begin with. They might not want bioplastics, because yeah, that stuff is also extremely hard to break down. And I know here in California, we have I think it might be 5 facilities. It might be, but it's in that number.
Okay.
That can even take food waste.
Uh-huh.
And most of them don't want these bioplastics in, because they are also considered inorganic material and it's not breaking down.
Yeah.
With the fiber, here's the other, don't invite me to parties.
You know too much, Jessica.
The downer.
I know, right?
Unless it's just a whole party of waste people and then we just become out depressed.
Right. And that happens, believe me.
Yes, we do have big waste parties.
We do that, yeah.
But these fiber-based containers, that are 100% fiber-based containers that the compost facilities can shred and they can compost really well, also have PFCs in them, flame retardant material.
Oh my God.
So that they don't leak. That's being taken care of, supposedly.
Oh my God.
So the certification for bioplastics, BPI and others came out and said, we recognize this is in there. We don't know, because there's not a lot of this material yet in compost facilities, so we can't test the soil to be like, how much PFCs are in the soil and is this having a negative effect? But they're taking the precautionary principle.
Okay.
And they're saying that in 2 years, in order to get your certification, you can't have this in your product. So they are taking the steps to do it.
Okay.
So I don't want to say 100% fiber-based material is bad, don't use it.
Yeah.
Just know that it just needs to get better, and they caught this issue. And
thank God. All right. Because I know I do both cold composting and hot composting. So I do the slow build of a pile until it's full kind of thing, and then turn it. And that's what most people are doing in their backyards. And certainly the compostable cutlery and whatnot does not break down in that. I have done what's called active batch thermal composting, where you build the pile all at once and it gets up to 150 degrees. And I've had compostable cutlery break down in that situation where you're monitoring the temperature and you're turning the pile as soon as the temperature peaks and all of that. And that said, sometimes even at the end of that process, I get the film that's left over from the inside of the, you know, Whole Foods food court takeaway box. That's still there, even though it got up to a high temperature. So, you know, I wanted to compost as much as possible in my life. And so I do throw my cotton t-shirts in there. They're not organic sometimes, and they have a logo printed on them. But you had said, I remember we were talking in this panel, and you was like, as long as you know what you're doing, you know, that you're doing this, that you're putting something that's got inorganic residues in it, you know, great. But for most people who don't know, it's important for them to understand that these residues are present.
Yeah, most people aren't composting in their backyard, and if they are composting in their backyard, they're not you, and they're not your community, right? So if it's going to a high heat facility, they don't know if that is a BPI certified compostable that would work its way out of the stream in 6 months or in 30 days. There are liners out there that will break down in those 30 days. There are stuff that says take it to a high heat facility, but my friend's been throwing it in her compost container and it's breaking down fine. Yeah. So there's stuff out there that does, but we in the industry don't know. So when they're looking at this, they may just skim it off because they don't want to have to deal with the fact that there's this product. Plus, if they can't have the inorganic, they may just skim it off anyways. Mm-hmm. If you're breaking this down into your, in your compost in your backyard, I would just say also, with the microfibers and any of the microplastics, that you just have to make sure they're contained. So you may have these plastics in your own soil, in your own garden, and it's not really going to cause that big of an effect per se. Mm-hmm. But once it starts getting into our water system and into a larger soil system, that can be an issue.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Okay. Well, I feel like we could go on forever about this, but it is tip time. So do you have a favorite tip that you would like to share with the Garden Nerd audience?
Yeah. I would just say, you know, because people say, well, what can I do to be zero waste? Or how can I start? Or how can I encourage people? And I think the first and foremost thing, we need to step back and realize that the solutions are not always on the consumer. And that, you know, there are many blogs out there that you can go and figure out how certain aspects and behavioral changes fit within your life and what is accessible to you. But I think as activists in this movement, we need to connect the dots and we need to push the conversation out further and figure out like, okay, yeah, I have a water bottle and I'm not supporting mass companies who are stealing water rights from, you know, from our hills here in San Bernardino. Mm-hmm. I will use my water bottle in order to get past that and to be able to fill up my water bottle at the tap. And this is a really easy thing that people can do. But the thing is, that's not an easy thing that a lot of people can do. People don't always have access to clean water. They don't have access to running water. So a water bottle is not a choice for them. Mm-hmm. But we want it to be a choice for everyone because clean water access is a human right.
Right.
You have individuals living here in Los Angeles and Compton and Willowbrook who have been fighting for clean water for many years now, and that they have to buy bottled water. They have to. They have to spend hundreds of dollars on their water bill every month, and then every month they have to spend $100 to $200 on water just so they can survive. So before we fill up our water bottle, before we grab our utensils, and the straw is even a whole nother issue, we need to stand in allyship with those individuals who do not have access. So if we're fighting for the concept of zero waste, then we need to fight for that right for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so we need to say, you need to make sure that, you know, what are you doing in order to spread the awareness of what's happening in Flint and still happening in Flint? Mm-hmm. What are we doing in order to spread the awareness of what's happening in Compton? And looking at how our choices, you know, it's a simple choice for me to go out and buy a coffee cup or a bottle or utensils or to buy in bulk. Actually, it's not simple for me to buy in bulk because I have severe allergies and I can't buy in bulk because of cross contamination.
I see.
So this is not accessible to everybody.
Yeah.
And mine's minimal in comparison to the rights, the access that other people have available to them. You know, not everyone is afforded that right. Not everyone financially can support themselves in those ways. And we need to support that infrastructure and that system. And we need to stand in allyship in those situations.
And so for people to take action in that direction, you would recommend that they contact their legislative representatives or go to the manufacturers and write letters? Or what do you think people should do that would be most effective?
Well, first we need to know what's happening in our community.
Mm-hmm.
And when we start seeing things like, I'm sure we all know about Flint, Michigan.
Yeah.
And the water issues happening there. So just being able to connect the dots back and be like, I can use a water bottle. Those people cannot.
Mm-hmm.
And, or a reusable water bottle, right? So we need to connect the issues, and where we are able to support, we need to be able to provide that support. When it comes to our own community, getting out and politically supporting where possible. When it's in communities outside of our own, can we financially support?
Mm-hmm.
Can we put, if we can't financially support, can we put information out into our interweb of information? Can we spread awareness and connect the issues so that we are bringing all these conversations together, all these quote unquote movements, I don't like that, but together, to be aware of legislation that's also happening. Take back program legislation. We tried to push take back program legislation for medicine and syringes in LA County, and we needed more people at the table to say, you know, our elderly and our disabled need this take back. They don't need to be the one that the responsibility is on them and they're trying to mail it, or they're trying to, you know, take it to a safe collection center so it's handled correctly. The pharmacy needs to take their responsibility and actually do something about this. So we need to stand with those issues and stand with those people in there. And for the state of California, Californians Against Waste is a great nonprofit organization where they can check out and see what legislation is going and where that support is needed.
Great. That is a good tip. That's a very important tip. I think, you know, even armchair activists can get involved in that kind of awareness, you know, promoting that kind of awareness. So thank you for that. That is an awesome tip. So where can people find you?
My website's still in development, but there is stuff on my website. So you can go to adventuresandwaste.org. And we also have we're partnering with SoCal 350 on a radio show called Eco Justice Radio, where we have a lot of amazing talks that you can check out. It's also aired on KPFK 90.7. But if you go to Adventures in Waste, all the ones that are related to connecting social justice issues with waste, those are my shows. And there's a handful of them up on our website at the moment. And then you can even check out more of those shows at Eco Justice Radio on SoCal350.org. And then also for the legislative, you know, going to Californians Against Waste, their website as well.
Okay, cool. Awesome. All right, Garden Nerds, you'll find Jessica's favorite resources listed at gardennerd.com. And we will share links to her radio show as well and a link for where to sign up for Jessica's newsletter, which, as you can tell by the content of this podcast, is going to be very informative. That's it for this week. Subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen. Visit us for tons of gardening information at gardennerd.com. You'll find us on Instagram and Twitter at gardennerd1, on Facebook as gardennerd.com, and of course, our Garden Nerd YouTube channel. Happy gardening!